I'm Peggy Pirro, and this is Food From Here. Brought to you by Swerka and More, working to support independent living and a better quality of life for seniors in southwestern Indiana. A mission that includes their intergenerational community garden partnership with Young and Established to help relieve food insecurity in our community. For the final episode of the summer, I thought we might take a virtual vacation to the island of Sicily. My guest this week is Nina Bambina, an accomplished home cook who lives with her husband Andy and their son here in Evansville now. But she grew up in Queens, New York, and spent her childhood summers with her extended family in Sicily. In a house with palatial doors that opened onto the beach, midday meals were served at a big family table, and food was always fresh and local and prepared from scratch, and often included her aunt's signature tomato sauce that Nina learned not to mess with. She still travels there frequently to see family and friends and get her fix of fresh Sicilian ricotta and that luscious green Sicilian olive oil. We hear her family stories and get some easy summer recipes and a glimpse of the Sicilian summer table on this end of the summer season episode of Food From Here. Nina Bambina, welcome to Food From Here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I wanted to have you on because you're a home cook. You are a scratch cook, and we might be in a shrinking segment of the population, at least in the U.S. I read a quote recently from Michael Pollan, his book Cooked, which is, I don't know if you've read it, it's subtitled A Natural History of Transformation, which I love because that's what cooking is. It's transformation. Anyway, his book suggested that our culture might be seeing the last of the scratch home cook. And I thought, I think he might be a little premature in that.
That breaks my heart, that thought. I can't believe it.
Yeah, it's a little disconcerting. And my second reaction after going, really, was to think, well, I don't know who he's hanging around with because I'm a scratch cook. Most of my friends are scratch cooks. And, I mean, yeah, we're all on the far side of 50. But my kid, who's like not quite 30, is also a scratch cook. So I think not dead yet, maybe.
I hope not. And I hope not for people because, gosh, what a difference it makes in your health and well-being to make things at home and not eat a lot of processed stuff. And, you know, in all fairness, people are busy and I understand that. 80-20 rule.
Yes. Yes.
I live by the 80-20
yes.
rule.
I do too. I am 80% plant-based 80% nice. Of the time.
Good
so
for
that,
you.
That leaves me a lot of wiggle room though. You know?
Yeah.
And when I go to friends, I don't make a thing about it. I just eat what's there because food is so much more than, you know, the specifics of what's on your plate.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that because something I thoroughly enjoy is when I have someone coming over to eat and they have a specific dietary requirement or preference to accommodate that and to make something that they love and enjoy and that we can all love and enjoy. You know, for me, it expands my technique, my ability, my understanding of food. And for them, they are so grateful. You know, food is love. Penzies has that, you know, love people, serve them good food.
Right.
He's got the bumper sticker.
We had that bumper sticker at Common Ground, and that was our motto for sure.
Yeah, and it's so true. And they are so grateful. We have some friends who are vegan. They've moved back to California now, but they came for Thanksgiving, and it made such an impression on her that, you know, something as simple as the mashed potatoes, I just used the vegan butter instead of using regular butter. And I, you know, didn't put in, I don't even know if I used almond milk or if we just skipped the milk. And they were able to eat everything except for the turkey. And then they ended up coming like every Thanksgiving after that. But she said she never forgot. And she recently posted on Facebook about it. I don't even remember how it came up. That her family had never, it was like, you bring whatever you want to eat. And they were not interested in changing anything. And she just felt so welcomed and so loved. And I said, well, why wouldn't I make something that you'll enjoy and that you're my guest?
So let's set the stage with a question about what mealtimes were like when you were a kid.
Well, it's interesting, as we've talked about, and you know, my family is Italian. So in America, it was, and I think this was common when we were younger, at least it was common in my neighborhood, you had to be home at 6 o'clock for dinner, period. No matter what was happening, no matter where you were. And the funny thing was, no one knew where you were until then anyway.
Right.
No one had any idea. Off you go, be back at six for dinner. And so we'd always have dinner around the table. My dad was an obstetrician gynecologist, and so he was not home a lot for dinner. But my mom had learned to cook from my aunt, his sister, who was the same age as her mother, because my dad was 21 years older than my mom. Mm. So his older sister is the same age as my American grandmother.
Huh.
Yeah. And my mom is Irish. She's third generation Irish. So her great grandparents on both sides came from Ireland. So her idea of cooking before she met my dad was a lot of boiling of things. And my dad was not interested in eating anything. He's from Sicily, lots of fresh vegetables, cooked really well. And my mom was on board. She loved it. And so my aunt took her under her wing like another mother and taught her how to cook. So we ate mostly Italian food, pasta every night with something else, not a giant bowl of pasta like Americans do, but, you know, a little bit of pasta. And mm-hmm. then you have your meat and your veg and, you know, a little starch maybe or maybe not, maybe just bread on the side. But the fun meals was when we would go to Italy in the summer. We'd go to Sicily, and my family has a house right on the beach, literally right on the beach. And they built it themselves, and it's got a great big hall with these huge doors, like got 16-foot ceiling, and the doors almost go all the way, and they panel all the way out. So the table would be right in that grand hall face, and like if you looked out, you know, to the head of the table where my uncle would sit, there was the beach out there.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. And it was wonderful. And, you know, you have the big meal at about 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon because it's too hot to be out. And the way the house was built with the really high ceilings and really thick walls, we never had air conditioning. We never needed it. All the windows, everything would be closed. The only thing that would be open were those giant doors. And the sun was behind us. So those doors just mm-hmm. faced out. And, you know, the shadow, the l'ombra, I'm thinking in Italian, the shadow came out over the doors. And so all of our family, my father was the youngest of seven, all come together, aunts, uncles, cousins, everybody. And we would have this huge, well, what to them is like dinner, but to us is lunch because it's at a, like middle of the day. We'd have the huge, you know, pranzo, as they call it. And that was always, I mean, such great food. When I'd first come home, even though my mom was a good cook, the ingredients, and, you know, now you can get much better, but in the 70s and early 80s.
Right.
And I just think, gosh, this is not the same thing. This watermelon tastes like nothing. This peach doesn't have any flavor. This tomato, ugh, this isn't a tomato.
We've come a long way.
We have.
With the locally with fresh food here, yeah. And the fresh foods that we have available to us now, yeah.
I love it.
But those meals in Sicily, who would cook them?
My aunt would cook them, and often her sister-in-law, my other aunt, would come over. She didn't live with us, but she'd come over, and they'd cook together. If everyone was going to be there, they'd cook together. And they would start in the morning at like 10 a.m., they would start cooking for this gaggle of people, and often fresh pasta and all the, you know, everything, the sauce, that's kind of a fascinating thing. And lots of Italians do it, and lots of Italians still do it. You take about a week in August when the tomatoes are so, I mean, you can eat a tomato in Sicily like an apple. You know, they don't, but I would. And they'd be like, you crazy American. And I'd say, you don't understand. It's a fruit. It's really a fruit. And they're like, yeah, we know. But they would take it. And then for an entire week, we would make the base, the sauce, you know, fare la salsa, making the sauce. And we would make enough sauce. We would can enough sauce. And we'd can sauce with just a little bit of basil in it. We'd can it with the pelato, which is the peeled tomatoes that they would chop up. And that one was always fun because you'd take a stick like a chopstick and you'd have the little funnel and you'd be pushing it in, yeah. pushing it in. And so that was like the kids' job. Like we would uh-huh. have to push it in. And, you know, they'd make that and they'd seal them all. I mean, it was a huge undertaking because for three households, we would make an entire year's worth of sauce.
And if you had to guess how many quarts.
God, I couldn't even tell you because I got to tell you, by the time we got about a third of the way through, this American kid was like, okay, everything in this world smells like tomatoes and I've had it. I'm leaving. So I never really saw like the finished product.
We'll just say lots of sauce.
So you could just imagine like how much sauce would that have been? So, you know, my aunt opens the can and then adds to it whatever. And, you know, she'd like to make a very simple sauce. And the two of them would make the pasta. But we ate store-bought pasta, too. You know, kind of a mix of both. And lovely eggplants. And, you know, even just the basic tomato salad there. You know, just tomato, red onion, red wine vinegar, oregano, a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper. Just delicious. When the tomatoes are that good, that's all you need.
So when you would you go for a couple of weeks at a time?
We'd usually go for a month.
A month.
Yeah.
And these meals would be produced daily?
Oh, yeah. Huh. Yep. And then you'd never eat leftovers at Pranzo, at the main meal. You'd often eat what was left from Pranzo would be what you had for cena, which is our dinner time. But for them, it's like 9:30 at night, especially in the summer in Sicily. So you eat and you finish eating about 2:30, depending on when you started. And the men immediately go to nap. The women clean up. But once you're done, then the women take a nap. Their nap is usually a little shorter than the men, but the men will take like an hour nap. And the women usually about a half an hour, but sometimes even an hour. And so stores and things, everything closes. And in August, things don't reopen for the whole month of August. Well, many things. And of course, that's changing with modernization. But when I was a kid, nothing reopened. They'd close at about 1. Some things would stay till 1:30. And then they'd be closed for the rest of the day. The month of August is considered their furlough month. They call it ferio. So it's the month of ferio, and everyone knows it. You just got to get your stuff done in the morning, and then everybody goes to the beach in the afternoon. You have your sleep, and then you go to the beach in the afternoon. So you eat late, and they have a little snack. They'll have a little snack in between the pranzo and cena, you know, lunch and dinner. And they don't go to bed. Not even the children. No one goes to bed till at least midnight. You know, restaurants don't even open till about 7:30. And if you're going to a place that they have pizza, if you arrive at 7:30, they'll tell you, listen, we just turned the ovens on. You're going to have to wait at least an hour for a pizza. We got to get the ovens hot. So it's when we first get there, we have to transition to our Italian way of being and realize, okay, we're going to be eating at 8 or 9 o'clock because that's the way everything goes. But then even with our son, even when he was young, you know, there's kids running around the restaurant at midnight and no one minds. And that's kind of normal. And it's totally normal. Walking the streets, whatever. By 1 o'clock, most people are in bed. But that kind of afternoon breakup with the nap changes the whole rest of the day.
I love that it's based around food. A big meal, a little meal, a late meal, an early meal. Does the day start early?
Yes and no. So there are people who the day starts early for, and then it's perfectly fine for your day to not start till 10, depending on your profession. There's more variability in their schedules than there are in America. It's not, you know, 9 to 5.
Yeah, sign me up. Did you participate in food preparation when you were a kid?
It's interesting. In America, I really don't have a lot of memory of whether my mom even tried to include me. But in Sicily, my aunt was always trying to include me because it was proper training for a young woman.
Poking those tomatoes.
Poking down the tomatoes, the palato, you know, and ironing and making the beds and tidying up and cooking. It was all part of it. And, you know, it's funny because my aunt was so much older, she was the age, she was our Italian grandmother in essence. My true Italian grandmother had passed before my parents were even married. I really just wanted to go out and play with my friends.
Sure.
And when I was about 18, I started realizing, oh, wait a minute, like I want to learn this. And she taught me something. Some things I just learned because they were my job. You know, there were certain things like I had to do, make the breadcrumbs from the stale bread. That was one of my jobs. I had to make at for dessert. We'd often have a thing called macedonia di frutta. So I don't know how to say that in English at all, but it's like chopped up fruit that you toss with a little bit of Marsala wine, a little tiny bit of sugar. If you have a little mint, sometimes even a little oregano in there. there, like just whatever. And that would often, so I always had to make the macedonia di frutta. So there were certain things that were my job. So those I learned whether I liked it or not. But then she wanted to teach me the other stuff. And when I was about 18, I realized, oh, you know, this is, I want to learn this. And so I learned some things from her. But then sadly, you know, by the time I was 20, she was getting Alzheimer's, and then she was taking care of my dying uncle while she had the Alzheimer's. And so I had two summers where I actually cared and wrote down some of her recipes and learned, you know, the ones that I really, really loved. She's got a great rabbit recipe, a great stuffed eggplant recipe. But I do lament that I wasn't, our ages didn't match, that if I had known her in my late 20s and 30s, oh my gosh, the things I could have learned.
Mm-hmm. It is kind of important to talk to older relations because we'll lose the information if we don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, we have so much at our fingertips now online, so many recipes, so many techniques we can learn, but they're not the family techniques and they're not the family recipes. So grab those while you can. And sometimes we don't realize, you know, when you're 18, you're not thinking about grabbing those while you can.
No. I'm glad I at least got 2 years. And she had a very specific sauce that she would make, which is interesting. She would use red onions in that lovely Sicilian olive oil. Oh, my gosh. There's nothing like it. It's so rich and it's so peppery, but so it's, you know, the color of it is such a deep green.
Mm-hmm.
And so she'd use that and she'd cut them up and it was an abundance of red onions. And then when she didn't have the tomato sauce, she would just, you know, peel the tomatoes and then cut them up and put the tomato. Sometimes she had the sauce. And so it was the red onion fried in the olive oil, the sauce, basil, salt, and sometimes a little bit of sugar, depending on the acidity. She did use just sugar for the acidity. That's it. Nothing else went in her sauce. And so once I asked her, I said, Zia, can you make a sauce with garlic in it? That's what I got. Her answer was. So I said, no, really, I love your sauce, and I'd just like to try it with garlic. So she doesn't really answer me. And the next day at Pranzo, she hands me my plate and she's like, okay, this one's for you. And on my plate is an entire bulb of garlic that she has cooked in the sauce that is on my plate for me. And I was like, okay, I'm not messing with your sauce again. She was not messing. That's how she made her sauce and you should like it that way.
Yeah.
And that's that.
And garlic seems to be, to my mind, such an integral part of the sauce, and it was not.
And it was definitely an insult for me to even ask for the garlic. And she cooked with garlic and other things,
right,
just not her sauce. Yep. And that's one of the things that I would never learn if I hadn't learned it from her. And so when I make sauce that way, the way she made it, that's Zia's sauce. Sometimes I make it with other stuff. But when I'm making Zia's sauce, it's just those ingredients.
Do you find yourself using cookbooks?
Yeah, you know, I have a lot of them. Many of us do who like to cook. And so if it's quick and easy, I'll go online. This is interesting about cookbooks. We lived in England for 5 years, and we didn't have a TV for about a year and a half. And I would sit and read my cookbooks at night. My sister-in-law used to think that was so absurd. She's not a cook. And I loved it because I had time to read all of, there's so much in a cookbook beyond the recipes, and often you just go to the recipes, or sometimes, I don't know about often, but I certainly did before I had that built-in time to read in my life because there was no television and there was no cell phones then, you know, wasn't all that other stuff. And so I guess that really taught me the appreciation of what you can find in a cookbook. That time that I spent with them. So I still use them, but I use both. I definitely use both. You know, if I have some odd ingredients and I want to figure out, okay, how do I use this stuff up? I just put it in online and there it comes.
Mm-hmm.
I love the America's Test Kitchen cookbook. They are good, and they're good when you read it because, like, we tried it this way and this didn't do that and this did this. So you really can learn from them. I love them. I have an Italian cookbook that I would love, if you ever come over, I'd love to show you. I got it in England. Surprisingly, it is the Encyclopedia of Italian Cooking, it's called. And it's not any like name or anything And it's by region. So each region has a section in the cookbook. And they really are, from what I know of Sicilian food, those are really pretty authentic. So I'm assuming the other regions are the same. And so I really like that cookbook.
What would be some foods that come to mind that would be authentic to Sicily?
Well, the one that anyone who knows me has heard this, that I am a cannoli snob.
Bad thing to be.
Yes, because cannoli is the dessert of Sicily. Mm-hmm. So here's a tip when you're going to Italy. Every region, and even I'd go so far as to say sometimes a town, will have their specialty dolce. Dessert, pastry in English, I guess we'd say. And so Sicily, the whole island, it is cannolis. And then there are some different kind of regional variation and little things. But you will not get the same cannoli outside of Sicily. And that is our dessert. And I always tell this funny story about Anthony Bourdain, you know, rest mm-hmm. his soul. He had that show. And he went to Sicily, which is a very funny episode to watch because Sicily is the best and the worst of Italy concentrated. And it comes through in that episode. You will see it. There are some things that I just got to shake my head and go, yeah, that's what a Sicilian would do. And they're not admirable, but they're survivors, Sicilians. But so he's with his little guide, the Italian guy, the Sicilian guy, and they go into the pastry shop and he says, I want this, this. And the guy goes, no, you have to have a cannoli. And he goes, no offense or anything, but I've had a lot of cannolis. I don't want a cannoli. I want to try something else. And the guy looks at him, stubborn. You know, Sicilians are so stubborn, testa dura, you know, hard-headed. And he says, no, you are in Sicily? And you must have a cannoli. And Anthony Bourdain comes right back at him and he says, no offense, really. I'm a chef in New York. I have eaten some dynamite cannolis. I want to try one of these other things. And he goes, you may try whatever you want, but first, you must have a cannoli. All right. So Anthony Bourdain's like, fine, I'll have a cannoli. So you see him and he brings the cannoli up to his mouth. And then you know how he do the voiceover. Mm-hmm. You hear the record scratching sound, that me. And then his voiceover goes, I had never eaten a cannoli.
What do you think it is that makes the Sicilian cannoli so Sicilian?
The ricotta. Uh-huh. It's the ricotta. I mean, Sicilian ricotta, it's always local. We make so much ricotta. And all that terroir, right? It's mm-hmm. the sea and the sun and the lemons and the grapes and all of that in that come out in the ricotta. And the artisan making of the ricotta, the way they make it, the process. It's, I would also say, I would go so far as to say ricotta is a food of Sicily. Even when I've had, now mind you, when I've been in the north, I'm in hotels and restaurants. I'm not in people's houses, so who knows for sure. But outside of Sicily, I've never tasted the ricotta of Sicily.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean, it is. If I could only eat one food for the rest of my life,
yeah,
it would be Sicilian ricotta. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Well, you can do a lot with it.
Yes.
You know, it can go sweet or savory.
Sweet or savory.
It's having a moment, in fact, in popular culture. Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
I'd love if we could get some better ricotta locally. That would be wonderful.
Yes.
Well, but, you know, in all fairness to Evansville, in the 17 years that we've lived here, there has been I would even go so far as to say an explosion of food options, both in stores and as far as restaurants.
Yeah, that's true.
It's come a long, long way.
For sure. So we're in summer, and we've had like heat waves, you know, since mm-hmm. April. So what are you cooking at home in this heat? And although we say, as we talk today, we're having a respite from the heat. I don't know how long it's going to last, but happy to have it. But, you know, July, August, these are hot months, and they're humid.
Mm-hmm.
So what do your taste buds go to in the summer?
A lot of lemon stuff.
Yeah?
Yeah, a lot of lemon stuff. I actually found online, I really loved it. I've made it a few times now, a salad that is grilled asparagus with feta cheese, lemon, and farro, which a lot of people don't use, but I love that grain. And then, talk about Sicilians make a really yummy, we use so much lemons and you know, tomatoes and lemons, and then the herbs that go with them, mint and basil, are big staples in the summer in Sicily. And we make this lovely, they call it like a sauce too. They call it a sugo, but I don't know, maybe you'd call it more like a pesto in English. But you take garlic, start with garlic, and I still do it the way that they did it. I take a glass bowl with a flat bottom. I chop up the garlic, and then I take a glass with a flat bottom, and I smush. There's probably a better way, but this is how we did it. And I kind of, you know, you kind of get the garlic really smashed in there with a little salt. Sorry, you got to put sea salt, and you want the coarse sea salt because it helps with the mashing. And you mash it up, and from that point, you can go either way. So at this point now, you could take basil and you mash up some basil, or you could take mint and you mash up some mint. And then the other option is you could either go now cut up tomatoes, mash them in, or lemon juice. You put the lemon juice and then you finish it off with olive oil.
Okay.
And you can do the mint in the tomato. You can do the basil with the lemon. You know, you can kind of interchange. And then what you do with it, and the one with the tomatoes, by the way, is actually called a pesto in Italian. The lemon one I've only ever heard called a sugo, a sauce. But the one that is the garlic with the salt, then you're adding the basil and the tomatoes, and then the olive oil, that is called pesto trapanese, which is the region of Sicily I'm from is Trapani, which is the northwest region of Sicily, and it's Trapani pesto, I guess you'd say in English. So okay. Pesto trapanese. Mm-hmm. And then what you do with it is you either put it on grilled, and when I say meat, they would use not a steak or whatever, they'd use a very thin piece of meat. I don't really know what that cut is called, but it's a thin piece of meat. I grab it when I see it, but I don't see it often in the store. They grill that, and then you'd put it on top. You could put it with pasta. You could put it on top of grilled vegetables, and the same thing with the lemon one. So the lemon one more often is paired with chicken, and you want to pound it thin, and then you grill it fast because you know how chicken is. It's just quick. And then you put that lemon sugo on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Could you do this in a food processor?
Probably. Yeah. I don't see why not.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure you could.
There's no magic in the flat bottom glass and the glass bowl.
I don't know. I guess I'd have to try it both ways and see, you know?
I guess if you were careful about pulsing it so you didn't turn it into something too smooth.
Yeah, you don't want to paste.
Right.
You know, you want, it is, I will say that it is something that the garlic is pungent, you know, so if you, it's good everybody's eating it because you're definitely going to have a little garlic lingering on your breath later. It is yummy. And that's something that I've made for people who are vegan and they love it on pasta, you know, tossing, not the lemon one with pasta. I've never tried that. I don't know how that would be. But the with pasta, the tomato one.
Yeah.
And I have one friend of mine that from graduate school, and I hadn't seen him for years. And we ran into each other at a conference and he said, you know, I still make that pesto trapanese with the pasta.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's respect.
Yeah, I was like, great.
You mentioned the grain. I pronounce it farro, but you pronounced it farro.
Farro, yeah.
Where do you find that locally?
Oh, they have it now. I'm pretty sure I got it at one of like my main three places that I go are Fresh Market, Fresh Time, and Good Old Schnucks. Mm-hmm. And one of those three just has it now. I can't remember which one it is.
Okay.
But
do you buy it in bulk or do you find it in a box?
It's in a bag on the shelf.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Yeah, they don't have it in the bulk section of Fresh Time, but it is in a bag. And I can't remember which one of those, but it's one of them has it.
I think we used to carry that at the River City Food Co-op because I remember using it in the past and I haven't used it for years.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a nice grain. It's pretty robust.
Oh, I love it. It's nutty. Mm-hmm. It's got a good bite to it.
Right.
Yeah, I can text you that salad. It was dynamite. I've made it for like three different events across the summer and it's always been a big hit.
So you get your summer produce mostly at these markets?
I do a mix. Uh-huh. I love going to the markets. I love it. I mean, that's where my heart is. I'm sad that Newburgh isn't having theirs.
The farmers markets we're talking about now.
Yeah,
just to
market.
Be clear. Yeah.
Yep. So I go between the bazaar, Franklin Street Bazaar, and the market on Main. So those two. And it just depends. If I'm busy, if we're away on the weekends and I can't get to it, then of course, you know, I'll go to the store. that's always my preference, to get the local stuff mm-hmm. and to support the people, the local growers. And, you know, and I'm fortunate that I can pay a little bit more for stuff to get local and to get organic and that kind of stuff. So I know everyone, not everyone is, but I do appreciate that I am. And so, yeah, those are my favorite places to go.
Are you finding anything outstanding this year at the farmers markets?
My favorite thing at the farmers market is those, and there at Franklin Street Bazaar, is the mushroom ladies.
Oh, sure.
Oh, my gosh, those yeah. mushrooms are fabulous. Mm-hmm. They're just gorgeous.
That is woods and stems.
Woods and stems.
Yeah, they came on and talked to us.
Yep, I saw that. Year. I haven't had a chance to listen to that, but they're yeah. great. And you know which one I really like is the pink oyster. Fry that up with a little bit of oil, a little bit of garlic, a little bit of oregano. And you know, I smuggle my oregano from Sicily. And I say smuggle because I don't buy, and it's not good, but I don't buy like the vac. I buy it from the farmer, mm-hmm. you know, and it's dirt cheap. And it's so, the perfume of it, the profumo, you know, it's so different than the American one. And it is one of my staples that I always bring back with me. And that little beagle will be there at, you know, the airport to smell.
Right.
And so I kind of hesitate. I pretend I'm doing something. I wait till he goes to someone else's luggage. And then I go like wide berth around him. And my husband teases me. He says, I see what you do with that beagle, you know. And I'm like, he's not taking my oregano.
Have you tried growing? I guess once it's picked, it won't go to seed. But have you tried growing it here?
You know, I would love to grow things in theory.
I gotcha.
I'm just not someone who ends up executing it very well. Maybe someday. You know, it is something I've always wanted to do. And our house was surrounded by gardens in Sicily. Literally, we didn't have yard. Forget Sicily. Our house in New York, in Queens, we lived on a corner. And our whole front yard, which was pretty big, was my uncle's garden. He lived in Brooklyn. He didn't have a garden. And so he would garden. And he was like a family friend who you called uncle, you know. But he would garden. And we'd get some of the stuff and he'd come. And I mean, it didn't even look necessarily nice. You know, mm-hmm. he had all the trellises and all the stuff for things to grow. And it was just a functioning garden.
Right.
But I never got in there with him. My dad was a doctor, so he wasn't doing it, you know. So Zio Mike would come over and do it. And I never, even in Sicily, you know, my younger brother would go out and help my uncle with the garden, with the watering and everything. But that's the men did the garden. You know, I'd go out to collect some mint or oregano or get an eggplant or whatever. But I never gardened. And so I never really learned how to do it. So for me, like my younger brother now has a nice garden at their place in Long Island. But for me, it's just never something I learned how to do. So it would take a fair bit of effort. You know, maybe once my son goes off to college.
Yeah.
Time will tell.
There is a learning curve I discovered with gardening. As with anything else, when I first moved here, I gardened a lot. I came from the coast, and so it was learning a new ecosystem, basically.
Wow.
And I realized, you know, after the third or fourth summer, that heat in July and me and working and weeding the garden that we do, it was just not compatible.
So, yep, it's good to learn those things yeah. about yourself.
So I was very glad to see the rise of the farmers markets.
Yeah.
Right about that same time here. It was yeah. like, oh, thank you so much. What's in your refrigerator most of the time?
Oh my gosh, so much stuff. We're very lucky. We moved into a house with a Sub-Zero. And it is packed. It is absurd how much stuff is in there. Of course, there's all the different kinds of sauces and all that, like soy sauce and hoisin sauce and this and that and whatever. But then I always have tons of fruits and vegetables. You know, I can throw something together like that. Yeah, all of a sudden people are over. Okay, let me start. Okay, first I'll cut up some cucumber and some cheese and I'll put that out. And then I'll start mixing stuff together and making stuff. So tons of fruits and vegetables. My pantry is stocked. I have every spice you could imagine and every, like Penzies, I'm putting his children through college. I don't know how old they are, but you know what I mean? And I've got all the grains and I've got all the different pastas and I've got, you know, all the different things. Our refrigerator is ridiculously full, I have to say. I'm like, how did, and when we lived in England, we had a tiny little, just bigger than like a dorm fridge. And I still cooked all the time there. I don't know how I did it. A lot of things just didn't go in the fridge. You know, eggs didn't go in the fridge, right. and onions didn't go in the fridge.
We expanded to fill the space that we have.
And that is absolutely true. And my refrigerator is loaded.
Do you have any appliances that you either avoid in the summer? I avoid my oven in the summer. I rarely use it. And I tend to use the crock pot in the summer, which might seem a little counterintuitive because we associate it with soups and stews, but I find it contains heat nicely and doesn't heat my kitchen.
Yeah.
But do you have particular appliances that you like at different times of the year?
Yeah, I do use my oven, although I'm thinking about getting, you know, kind of one of those countertop smaller ovens for the heat issue, because I do love using the oven. I do a lot of roasted stuff, but of course we have the grill, you know, but we have a charcoal grill. And so my husband tends to do it. I'm sure I could do it if I had to, but I'm not really interested in figuring out how to use the chimney and do all that stuff. Mm-hmm. When we had a gas grill, I would use it more, but I do agree with him. The flavor is better for the charcoal grill. So he does the grilling. So when he's, you know, busy or whatever, and I want something roasted or whatever, I still use my oven. So I tend to lean towards a lot of pan stuff, but also I do a lot of stuff that isn't cooked in the summer. You know, doing a lot of raw vegetables in all different ways, either roasted or raw, is what I do a lot of in the summer.
Have you explored the charcuterie boards?
I get a little crazy with the charcuterie boards. I cannot make a small charcuterie board. And plus, you know, I have like the fig jam or the raspberry jam or the different mustards in my fridge because I use all this stuff. So yes, I love a charcuterie board that has, you know, to me, if it's just the cheese and the meats, the salumi, as they say in Italian, It's you know, I need some raspberries. I need some cucumber, a little bit of, you know, depending on what's in season, throwing. Like, so when we're going more towards the winter, some cut up apple or pear on there. Mm-hmm. And this time of year, you know, maybe some peach or plum or something like that for me. And then I love to, you know, I get out my pensies. My husband teases me. I got to put my pensies on everything. And so even let's say if I just have some cut up cheese, I'll get some smoked paprika. And put that on the cheese.
Yeah. Sounds great.
Yeah. Or, you know, I'll put a little bit of rosemary, you know, grind it up onto a different kind of cheese. Or I'll put like a little bit of some kind of seasoning on the cucumbers. You know, so I add in seasonings as well. And then I'll usually put some kind of herb. It may not necessarily be part of it, but for decoration, you know, I'll put a little bit on there. And I end up eating a little bit of it myself.
Where are you getting your cheeses?
Oh, I get them everywhere. Aldi, of course, is awesome. Schnucks, you know, for a while, and God bless Amy Bloom, she was writing about it and pushing it. They had some interesting cheeses. I don't think they did as well with them as they would have liked. So they've kind of pared down, but you can still get decent cheeses there. Fresh Market has great cheeses. You know, Fresh Thyme, they do have that little one in the middle now where they have more cheeses. For interesting different cheeses, either Fresh Market or Aldi are my go-to.
We haven't talked about beverages. Do you have particular beverages that you serve or that you just drink yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I drink, water is like my go-to, but with food, it's the Italian way, right? What pairs with the food? So if I'm having sausages and sauerkraut, I want a nice beer. If I'm having something more Italian, I want wine. If it's the summer, I prefer a white wine. If it's something a little more complex in the summer, a nice dry rosé. And I'll tell you a funny story about beverages in Italy. So Italians, it's Sicilians. I don't know about the North, but I'm assuming it's the same. They're very specific about the things you should eat in a certain way. And so, right, in the summer, if you are mostly drinking white wine. If you have fish, you are drinking white wine, period. And my girlfriend from America came with me one summer, and she loves red wine. And we only drink the local wine when we're there. There's no point in paying for an expensive bottle of wine. It's just a waste of your money. The local wine is so good and so fresh and dynamite. So we'd always get a half a liter. You know, on a Friday night, maybe we'd get a liter. But it comes, you know, in a little jar. It's almost like America where you get beer on tap. It's like wine on tap. And so she would always want the red. So I would say, fine, we'll get the red. And so I'd order the red. And the waiter would look at me and he'd say, Signora, ma perché vino rosso? Why red wine? It's fish. It's the summer. And I'd say, well, you know, my friend likes it. And they go, oh, okay. Does she know that it pairs better with the white wine? Like, okay, we're going to educate this American woman. And I said, well, okay, I'll tell her. And I said, do you know that it would taste better with white wine? And she says, yeah, but I like white wine, red wine. And I said, yeah, but she likes red wine. Va bene, okay. And then my husband had this funny one happen where we were at my dear, dear friend's mother's house, and they lived right across the street from me. So she's like another mother, an aunt or whatever to me. And they were first meeting Andy, and he likes coffee black. But you in Sicily, you never drink espresso black. It's not American black coffee. It's absurd to them. So she's got our little tazzinas, our little espresso cups, and she's pouring, and she's, you know, doctored. She's putting in the sugar for you as a good hostess would and stirring it up. And so she says, well, how much sugar does Andy want? So I said, well, Andy, how much sugar do you want? And he goes, no, I don't want any sugar. So he doesn't want any. So she freezes, and she goes, he doesn't want any? So I say, you don't want any? He says, no, I don't want any. And she says, does he know it's bitter? Do you know it's bitter? He says, yeah, I know it's bitter. I said, yeah, he knows it's bitter. And she looks at him and she looks at me. She goes, I'll just give him one. She just stirs one in. She is not handing over this cup of espresso in its bitter form without at least a little bit of sugar.
Oh, I love that.
It happens a lot. If you break their food rules, they will tell you and they are not happy about it.
But they tell you. And there's something kind of nice about that, actually. Mm-hmm. They instruct you.
Yeah, and they know the reason why. Mm-hmm. It's not just this is what we've always done. It's right. Like, well, this flavor does better with that. The fish is delicate, and so the more delicate wine is going to complement the fish rather than overpower it.
Do you have, well, I think you mentioned the ricotta, so this I might have already answered this question, but do you have a desert island food?
Yeah, that's my desert island food is ricotta, but not any. Like, I'm not talking, you know, the Bel Gioioso or whatever that you buy here in Evansville. It's got to be that Sicilian ricotta. And my friend laughs because my best friend Caterina in Sicily, when I get there, she always has. So you buy it in a basket where as you're ready to eat it, you take it out and let the milk come out of it. It's like that. And she has that in the fridge for me. And she's like, va bene, Nina. Okay, Nina, go ahead. Guess what's in the fridge? And I go in and I'm like, oh, get that, Nina. And I take a nice slice and I just, oh my gosh, I put it in my mouth. It's so delicious.
That's a true friend.
That's a true friend. She knows that I'm a ricotta nut.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the route you took to get to Evansville, Indiana.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting one. Yeah, so my husband and I, we met in graduate school. We were both at Columbia in New York, and he got his first job teaching in England. I wasn't finished my dissertation yet, so off we went to Reading, which is about a half an hour west of London. And I finished my dissertation long distance, coming back and forth a couple of times a year. We were there for 5 years, and then it was time to start a family, and the university there was doing some funny stuff with their departments and sociology and stuff. So it just all seemed to come together. And he interviewed at two places in the States and ended up getting the job at USI. So here we came to Evansville, Indiana, that I had never even heard of. And my brothers, who were huge Yankee fans, you know, they were like, it's Don Mattingly's hometown. Of course, Evansville. And I said, well, I'm okay, whatever. My husband has actually seen Don Mattingly. I still have, although maybe I would have seen him and not even know. Right. I kind of know what he looked like in the 80s. Right. I don't know if he looks the same anymore. But yeah, so we ended up here and I stayed home the first year with my son. And at the end of that year, we were at a picnic, a new faculty picnic. And I was talking to the then assistant provost, Brian Posler, about the work I had done at Columbia. And I was president of the student government and I did a lot of administrative stuff with that. And he emailed Andy like a week later and he said, look, you know, we have this position as a director of the honors program at USI. It's part time, air quote, part time. And I think Nina would be great for it. Of course, she'd have to apply and get references and all that and go through the normal thing. But if she makes it, we'd love to have her. And so I went back, which was good. I was the kind of person who 1 year home with my son was good. I was mm-hmm. ready to start doing something else. You know, I applaud women who can stay home for a long time with their kids. It's an important job. I needed something a little different. And then I worked there for almost 10 years running the honors program, and I loved it. I loved my colleagues. I loved my students. I loved my beautiful office.
But you left.
I left. Yep. I hit an unfortunate wall, and it was time to move on. And when I left, I really didn't know what I was going to do next. And I had done yoga and meditation for, you know, since my 20s, and now I was in my 40s. And so I went to Evansville Power Yoga, where I did yoga. And Mark Goldchoy, that many people know, he said to me, well, our teacher training is starting soon. Have you ever thought about it? And I said, well, I have a lot. Actually, many times in life I'd consider yoga teacher training, but I just never had the time. Mm-hmm. And, well, now I have the time. So I took yoga teacher training, loved it. And a doctor from Owensboro, Kay Corpus, some people know her, she came to teach us about our chakras or our energy centers. And she started, just incidentally, it wasn't planned, she started doing healing touch on Mark's, I think it was his knee was bothering him or something. And I just remember thinking, oh my gosh, what is that? And my background in sociology is medical sociology was my subfield. And that came from my dad had been a doctor, and my mom was a nurse, and my grandmother was a nurse, and my cousin was a doctor. So lots of doctors and nurses. And I started working in doctor's offices when I was in college. My dad had passed, and my mom needed some help with the rent and stuff. And so I had part-time jobs. And then when I graduated college, I had a degree in sociology, but I started working at a hospital, a doctor's office that was part of a hospital. And I did that for a few years, and just I didn't like the way the doctors treated us. I didn't like that kind of, I was like, you know, I need more education. And when I went back to graduate school, that's when I discovered medical sociology. My two worlds came together. And interestingly, here I am doing yoga, and it's like three worlds came together. You know, a little bit of the sociology, a little bit of the medicine, a little bit of the yoga and meditation all kind of came together in energy work.
And from there, you launched a practice of your own.
Yeah. My focus, my mm-hmm. gift, whatever it is I help people eliminate from their brain, because I have to bring in the science. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a social scientist at heart, and the medical background too. You know, so those kinds of things, I marry it together. And so I've done a lot of research on our bodies and our brains and trauma. So I help people move through trauma, move through the stress cycle, both in their brain and in their body and in their energy body. And so we clear it out of all three. It's very powerful, and it's a beautiful way. I mean, I just feel so blessed, honored, fortunate to help people heal those old deep wounds and come to a place where they can respond to their life rather than react based on old pains and traumas. It's a really beautiful thing. I feel very honored to be able to help people walk that path and come out the other side. It's really powerful stuff.
Nina Bambina's practice is called Energy for Serenity. You'll find a link to it in the show notes, along with a recipe for pesto a la trapanese. Many thanks to Nina for sharing her stories and her love of good food with us on Food From Here. Food From Here is sponsored by Swerka and More, supporting independent living and improving the quality of life for seniors in southwestern Indiana, and partnering with Young and Established in an intergenerational community garden project to help relieve food insecurity in our community. And that's a wrap on our summer season. Join me again in September when we'll get an update on Bedford Collab, the community kitchen project in Teepee Park.
And we'll hear from the chef at Turntable, the local catering business that's found a home at Arcademy in downtown Evansville. Also this fall, we'll meet the owners of a Posey County farm who are bringing a little of the Southwest to our local markets. Join us in September for Season 3 of Food From Here, produced by Tri-State Media in downtown Evansville, home of WNIN-FM and WNIN-PBS. Thanks to Swerka and Moore, and to listeners like you. I'm Peggy Pirro. See you again in the fall.